is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
Diversity, equity, inclusion, DEI, the programs, the recommendations, the high profile of DEI these last years brings to an editorial of the Wall Street Journal most recently revelations that are surprising to me, given its prominence in the conversation of the English culture, the British culture, and the American culture. This is a report presented to the Business and Trade Secretary of Parliament. It goes on to say, causality between interventions and outcomes is often near impossible to discern, even if positive correlation should be taken seriously. Definitive claims of what works can be misleading or inconclusive. Results in one context cannot necessarily be replicated in another, as workplaces are complex social environments and countless variables. That's a lot of 25-cent words saying it's not working the way we'd hoped. And why is that? I welcome Victor Davis Hanson of the Hoover Institution. He writes very carefully at American Greatness about DEI and analogies to DEI that have not worked in the past. And yet here we are still struggling with, are we successful? Should we try again? Have we spent enough money? Victor, a very good evening to you. This report out of the United Kingdom comports completely with large words that are very difficult to put together, that it's impossible to know whether DEI has any effect whatsoever because the workplace changes so profoundly from place to place. Your observation of DEI, that not only is it not working, but that it's damaging our culture. You use historical examples. I want to begin with what the Red Army went through in 1941 to 1945. What did Stalin learn of the failure of DEI? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Stalin attached commissars all the way down to the battalion level, and they had a veto power over commanders, our equivalent of 4-star down to 1-star. In other words, if they wanted to retreat or have a tactical withdrawal, that was considered usually contrary to Marxist-Leninist ideology, and they were prevented. But after they had lost 5 million people in 1941, and then in early 42, they lost another 3 million. And by October of 1942, Stalin said, no, we're going to give complete battlefield command decision-making to Zhukov or Rostovsky or Konev, the great three generals. And they started winning. And they made their decisions based on classical military doctrine. And the idea was that the Red Army was spending a lot of money and time and labor auditing military decisions without enriching military decisions based on ideology that was irrelevant to the actual reality on the ground. So it was an act of omission. They were wasting that resource. And then more importantly, it was an act of commission, because they were often demanding certain types of military maneuvers or procedures that aided the Wehrmacht in its war against the Red Army. And they quit finally.
A witticism from the Winter War, Finland versus the Soviet Union in 1940. See if I can get it straight. Three Russians were captured by the Finns, and two of them were common soldiers, and one was a political commissar. And these common soldiers had been told the Finns would execute them immediately, but it didn't happen. They were marched back as prisoners of war. And they said, you're not going to shoot us? And the Finns said, of course not. You're prisoners of war. And their remark was, well, give us your rifle then, we'll shoot him. And that was that was a joke from the Winter War, but it comports with what you just said. Now, the one that convinced me is Napoleon I. Why was he so successful against the various combinations of his enemies?
Well, he had a problem because, you know, after the excesses of the Jacobin Reign of Terror and the reaction to it first in the Directory and then as consul and as emperor, he actually kept the spirit of the revolution, and he got rid of aristocratic privilege. Didn't mean his marshals were not aristocratic, but they were not aristocratic only. And so he tried to combine revolutionary egalitarianism with merit, and all so those great 20 or 25 marshals of France that were far better for the most part than their counterparts in Europe were selected and retained and promoted mostly on the basis of merit, not aristocratic birth and not revolutionary fervor or Jacobinism or any of that stuff. And that really paid big dividends for almost two decades. It wasn't that it was perfect, but there were a lot, and that filtered down through the Grand Army, that there was a level of promotion and rewards that were clearly correlated to how you performed on the battlefield rather than who you knew or what your ideology was.
And so with the Stalinist Red Army, it was based on Marxist-Leninist theory, and that failed. With the French Army, it was based on the Bourbon standards. Aristocracy knows better, and that failed. Now we come to Mao, especially the Cultural Revolution, known as the Red Guard, when he endorsed teenagers to rampage the land, steal and plunder and murder and torture. How did that work out, Victor?
Well, they had a decade of it. And these decisions that were made on the economy, the military, politics were all ideological, and they were in tune with Mao's little red book of constant revolution. So they thought that, you know, little villages should be making iron. So they made little pot iron. They had to throw it all away. It was worthless. Or the Red Army, as you know, when it went into Vietnam, it performed very poorly because it was still run by ideologues and commissars who, any decision that was made, they had to verify it or audit it or guarantee that it fit Mao's doctrine. And often, of course, it didn't. And therefore, they made a number of strategic and tactical mistakes. The irony was that by 1976, during the reforms, they dropped all of that. And although the Communist Party was still autocratically in control, they started to use free market principles on the economy and merit-based promotions in the Red Army. And today, you can make the argument that they are careful not to put ideological blinders on military decision maker. And that's why the Red Army and People's Liberation Army, I should say, is pretty considered pretty fearsome. And it would be very ironic if our woke military now is learning from the Maoist revolution and the current People's Liberation Army is learning from 200 years of American military meritocracy.
One more example, and this one I had forgotten about entirely. Muammar Gaddafi's Green Book. How did that work out, Victor?
You know, I was in Libya for a couple of weeks, and everybody hated it, but they had this Green Book about his principles of permanent revolution. And it was very crazy. They were going to be self-sufficient, not tainted by Western pollution or ideological contamination. So everybody had to have a chicken. And if people would come up with these stories, they had a chicken in their bathtub, their shower, in their apartment, high-rise apartments. Anybody found with a violin was guilty of a felony. They had burned every violin they could find to erase their colonial past. Anybody who would marry someone from what they call Black Africa and have two children would get $10,000 bonus. They had to be married for, I think it was 5 years. And then you saw all these poor women that were abandoned on the streets. And, you know, I was driving once back to the airport, and the potholes were everywhere. This was 2007. And our car, a Russian-made car, went into a pothole, and we couldn't get it out. So the driver and I and another passenger lifted this little car out, and I asked him, why do you have oil and you have potholes? Can't you pave with asphalt? It's an oil product. And he says, well, we always hire first our first cousin, and it's always our worst first cousin. So what he was saying is that not only do we have a kind of a commissar system ideologically, but we're still captured with tribalism, that we make decisions on merit, who gets to work at the DMV or who pilots a plane based on their tribal affiliations, which clan in Libya that they belong to. And that's why the Middle East in general hasn't been working as well as it should, given its natural wealth.
Now we come to the ideology of the Old South, King Cotton. And you make the very blunt statement, all accurate, and the statistics overwhelm, that the South was decades, if not 100 years behind the North because of its ideology. And that continued in the revival after the war. And right up until modern times because of the investment in the ideology of slavery, superiority, segregationism, as opposed to the marketplace. Is that correct, Victor?
Yeah. Cotton was a huge foreign exchange winner, but it didn't help the majority of the population. The cotton kings were the wealthiest people, I think, since Silicon Valley grandees. And so all of the money, such as it was in the government, was used for ports to export cotton and to perpetuate slavery. And then most of those civilian codes of slavery laws and statutes were just Byzantine. One drop, 1/16th made you black. You could be manumitted if you were 1/8. They adjudicated the color of one's skin. They had all sorts of weird rules about which slave could be manumitted, which slaves could marry, which ones could go in the house, which ones that. And it was just a drag on the economy, but more importantly, it never fostered manufacturing or assembly, construction, infrastructure, roads, bridges, rails. It was, and so when the war broke out, they were a one crop economy. When you boycotted and embargoed and forbid cotton to be exported to Britain, the whole economy collapsed and they had no resiliency. And so it was obsessed with racial purity. And I don't know if we still use the 1/16th drop, but we do. The universities must, in a multiracial society where intermarriage is so common, none of us are what we think we are. And I don't know what standard they use to adjudicate whether you're black or Latino and eligible for special admittance, but they must use some.
Now we come around to DEI one more time in ideology. The British authors say that the terms diversity, inclusion, and other associated terminology are conceptually ambiguous, rapidly evolving, and often conflated. You identify the fact as DEI is a conglomerate that ignores talent, character, morality, history. It ignores all of that and substitutes an ideology of either race or origin. And that history suggests it is not succeeding and it cannot succeed. Is it too early to summarize that?
No, I don't think so. I think what's happened is what people ignored and they thought that DEI was sort of a parlor game in the faculty lounge has now permeated the corporations. And any corporation who's embodied it, whether it's Disney or Anheuser-Busch or Target, has taken a massive loss. We should remember that the CEO of United promised that 50% of his pilots, not entering, but exiting their pilot and crew training programs would be DEI candidates. And in the last 10 days, they've had six, I think I counted them, serious near misses or problems with command and control or running off the runway or panels falling off. Boeing is the same thing. They just fired their CEO. They were bragging that they had DEI. Even the owners of the ship that hit, if you go on their website, as I did yesterday, they have a huge website that's devoted almost all to DEI, not about navigational aptitude or experience. And when you go to the military, John, we're down 40,000.
Right.
Recruits. And when you look who's not signing up, it's not so-called DEI potential recruits. It's white males who have died at double their numbers in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I've come up with a short way of saying that, Victor. It's always 1942. Do something.
Yeah.
So it's always, why are we losing?
And they don't know what to do. But I have noticed that the commercials now on television that are recruitment commercials for the military are they're pictures of people jumping out of helicopters or hitting the beach or flying planes. They're not, pregnant women in flight suits anymore. I guess they have understood what they did to the military. That was going back to General Milley and Lloyd Austin, the defense secretary.
I want to turn to the police department when we come back because that's an aspect of DEI. Victor Davis Hanson of the Hoover Institution. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Patrick.